The Clan of the Cave Bear, a novel by Gene M. Owl. Copyright 1980 by Gene M. Owl, all rights reserved. Author's dedication, for Ray, my worst critic and best friend. Author's acknowledgments. No book published is ever solely the work of the author. Assistance comes from a variety of sources in as many different ways. But some contributions to my work came from people I have never met and probably never will. I am grateful, nonetheless, to the citizens of the City of Portland and the County of Multnomah, Oregon, whose taxes support the Multnomah County Library, without whose reference materials this book would not have been written. I am also grateful to the archaeologists, anthropologists, and other specialists who wrote the books from which I gathered most of the information for the setting and background of this novel. There were many who helped more directly. Among them, I want especially to thank Jin DeCamp, the first to hear my story idea, who was a friend when I needed one, who read a fat manuscript with enthusiasm and a meticulous eye for errors, and who sculpted a symbol for the series. John DeCamp, friend and fellow writer who knew the agonies and the ecstasies and had the uncanny knack of calling exactly when I had to talk to someone who did. Karen Owl, who encouraged her mother more than she ever knew because she laughed where she was supposed to laugh and cried where she was supposed to cry, though it was a first draft. Kathy Humble, of whom I asked the greatest favor one can ask of a friend, honest criticism, because I valued her sense of words. She did the impossible. Her critique was both acutely perceptive and gentle. Deanna Sterrett, for getting caught up in the story and who knew enough about hunting to point out some oversights. Lana Elmer, who listened with unflagging attention to hours of dissertation and still liked the story. Anna Bacchus, who offered her unique insights and her sharp eye for spelling. Not all my research was done in libraries. My husband and I made many field trips to learn firsthand various aspects of living close to nature. In the line of direct experience, special thanks are due to Frank Heil, Arctic survival expert with the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, who showed me how to make my bed in a snow cave and then expected me to lie in it. I survived that cold January night on the slopes of Mount Hood and learned much more about survival from Mr. Heil, who has my vote as the one I'd most like to be around during the next ice age. I am indebted to Andy Van Hull for sharing with me his special knowledge of living in the natural environment. He showed me fire making without matches, axes made of stone, cord twining and basket weaving, sinew and rawhide, and how to nap my own stone blade that cuts through leather as though it were butter. Gratitude beyond measure goes to Jean Nager, a literary agent so good she turned my wildest fantasy into reality and then bettered it. And to Carol Barron, my shrewd, sharp, and sensitive editor, who believed in the reality, then took my very best effort and made it better. Finally, there are two individuals who had no idea they were helping me, yet whose assistance was invaluable. I have since met one of them, but the first time I heard writer and teacher Don James talk about the writing of fiction, he didn't know he was talking directly to me. He thought he was addressing a whole group. The words he said were exactly those I needed to hear. Don James didn't know it, but I might never have finished this book if it wasn't for him. The other is a man I know only through his book. Ralph S. Solecki, author of Shanidar, Alfred A. Knopf, New York. The story of his excavation of Shanidar Cave and discovery of several Neanderthal skeletons profoundly moved me. He gave me a perspective of prehistoric caveman I might not otherwise have had, and a better understanding of the meaning of humanity. But I must do more than thank Professor Solecki. I must apologize for one instance of literary license I took with his facts for the sake of my fiction. In real life, it was a Neanderthal who put flowers in the grave. The Clan of the Cave Bear, Chapter 1. The naked child ran out of the hide-covered lean-to toward the rocky beach at the bend in the small river. It didn't occur to her to look back. Nothing in her experience ever gave her reason to doubt the shelter and those within it would be there when she returned. She splashed into the river and felt rocks and sand shift under her feet as the shore fell off sharply. She dived into the cold water and came up sputtering, then reached out with sure strokes for the steep opposite bank. She had learned to swim before she learned to walk, and at 5 was at ease in the water. Swimming was often the only way a river could be crossed. The girl played for a while, swimming back and forth, then let the current float her downstream. Where the river widened and bubbled over rocks, she stood up and waded to shore, then walked back to the beach and began sorting pebbles. She had just put a stone on top of a pile of especially pretty ones when the earth began to tremble. The child looked with surprise as the stone rolled down of its own accord and stared in wonder at the small pyramid of pebbles shaking and leveling themselves. Only then did she become aware she was shaking too, but she was still more confused than apprehensive. She glanced around, trying to understand why her universe had altered in some inexplicable way. The earth was not supposed to move. The small river, which moments before had flowed smoothly, was roiling with choppy waves that splashed over its banks as the rocking stream bed moved at cross purposes to the current, dredging mud up from the bottom. Brush close by the upstream banks quivered, animated by unseen movement at the roots, and downstream, boulders bobbed in unaccustomed agitation. Beyond them, stately conifers of the forest into which the stream flowed lurched grotesquely. A giant pine near the bank, its roots exposed and their hold weakened by the spring runoff, leaned toward the opposite shore. With a crack, it gave way and crashed to the ground, bridging the turbid watercourse, and lay shaking on the unsteady earth. The girl started at the sound of the falling tree. Her stomach churned and tightened into a knot as fear brushed the edge of her mind. She tried to stand, but fell back, unbalanced by the sickening swaying. She tried again, managed to pull herself up, and stood unsteadily, afraid to take a step. As she started toward the hide-covered shelter set back from the stream, she felt a low rumble rise to a terrifying roar. A sour stench of wetness and rot issued from a crack opening in the ground, like the reek of morning breath from a yawning earth. She stared uncomprehendingly at dirt and rocks and small trees falling into the widening gap as the cooled shell of the molten planet cracked in the convulsion. The lean-to, perched on the far edge of the abyss, tilted as half the solid ground beneath it pulled away. The slender ridgepole teetered undecidedly, then collapsed and disappeared into the deep hole, taking its hide cover and all it contained with it. The girl trembled in wide-eyed horror as the foul-breathed, gaping maw swallowed everything that had given meaning and security to the 5 short years of her life.
"Mother! Mother!"
she cried as comprehension overwhelmed her. She didn't know if the scream ringing in her ears was her own in the thunderous roar of rending rock. She clambered toward the deep crack, but the earth rose up and threw her down. She clawed at the ground, trying to find a secure hold on the heaving, shifting land. Then the gap closed, the roar ceased, and the shaking earth stilled. But not the child. Lying face down on the soft, damp soil churned loose by the paroxysm that convulsed the land, she shook with fear. She had reason to fear. The child was alone, in a wilderness of grassy steppes and scattered forests. Glaciers spanned the continent on the north, pushing their cold before them. Untold numbers of grazing animals and the carnivores that preyed on them roamed the vast prairies, but people were few. She had nowhere to go, and she had no one who would come and look after her. She was alone. The ground quivered again, settling itself, and the girl heard a rumbling from the depths, as though the earth were digesting a meal gulped in a single bite. She jumped up in panic, terrified that it would split again. She looked at the place where the lean-to had been. Raw earth and uprooted shrubs were all that remained. Bursting into tears, she ran back to the stream and crumpled into a sobbing heap near the muddy water. But the damp banks of the stream offered no refuge from the restless planet. Another aftershock, this time more severe, shuddered the ground. She gasped with surprise at the splash of cold water on her naked body. Panic returned. She sprang to her feet. She had to get away from this terrifying place of shaking, devouring earth. But where could she go? There was no place for seeds to sprout on the rocky beach, and it was clear of brush. But the upstream banks were choked with shrubs just sending forth new leaves. Some deep instinct told her to stay near water. But the tangled brambles looked impenetrable. Through wet eyes that blurred her vision, she looked the other way, at the forest of tall conifers. Thin beams of sunlight filtered through the overlapping branches of dense evergreens crowding close to the stream. The shaded forest was nearly devoid of undergrowth, But many of the trees were no longer upright. A few had fallen to the ground. More leaned at awkward angles, supported by neighbors still firmly anchored. Beyond the jumble of trees, the boreal forest was dark and no more inviting than the brush upstream. She didn't know which way to go, and glanced first one way, then the other with indecision. A tremble beneath her feet while she was looking downstream set her in motion. Casting one last yearning look at the vacant landscape, childishly hopeful that somehow the lean-to would still be there, she ran into the woods. Urged on by occasional grumbling as the earth settled, the child followed the flowing water, stopping only to drink in her hurry to get far away. Conifers that had succumbed to the quaking earth lay prostrate on the ground, and she skirted craters left by the circular tangle of shallow roots, moist soil and rock still clinging to their exposed undersides. She saw less evidence of disturbance toward evening, fewer uprooted trees and dislodged boulders, and the water cleared. She stopped when she could no longer see her way and sank down on the forest floor, exhausted. Exercise had kept her warm while she was moving, but she shivered in the chill night air, burrowed into the thick carpet of fallen needles, and curled up in a tight little ball, throwing handfuls over herself for a cover. But as tired as she was, sleep did not come easily to the frightened little girl. While busy making her way around obstacles near the stream, she was able to push her fear to the back of her mind. Now it overwhelmed her. She lay perfectly still, eyes wide open, watching the darkness thicken and congeal around her. She was afraid to move, almost afraid to breathe. She had never been alone at night before, and there had always been a fire to hold the black unknown at bay. Finally, she could hold back no longer. With a convulsive sob, she cried out her anguish. Her small body shook with sobs and hiccups, and with the release, she eased into sleep. A small nocturnal animal nosed her in gentle curiosity, but she wasn't aware of it. She woke up, screaming. The planet was still restless, and distant rumbling from deep within brought back her terror in a horrifying nightmare. She jerked up, wanted to run, but her eyes could see no more wide open than they could behind closed lids. She couldn't remember where she was at first. Her heart pounded. Why couldn't she see? Where were the loving arms that had always been there to comfort her when she woke in the night? Slowly, the conscious realization of her plight seeped back into her mind, and shivering with fear and cold, she huddled down and burrowed into the needle-carpeted ground again. The first faint streaks of dawn found her asleep. Daylight came slowly to the depths of the forest. When the child awoke, it was well into the morning, but in the thick shade, it was difficult to tell. She had wandered away from the stream as daylight faded the previous evening, and an edge of panic threatened as she looked around her at nothing but trees. Thirst made her aware of the sound of gurgling water. She followed the sound and felt relieved when she saw the small river again. She was no less lost near the stream than she was in the forest, but it made her feel better to have something to follow, and she could quench her thirst as long as she stayed near it. She had been glad enough for the flowing water the day before, but it did little for her hunger. She knew greens and roots could be eaten, but she didn't know what was edible. The first leaf she tasted was bitter and stung her mouth. She spit it out and rinsed her mouth to remove the taste, but it made her hesitant to try another. She drank more water for the temporary feeling of fullness and started downstream again. The deep woods frightened her now, and she stayed close to the stream where the sun was bright. When night fell, she dug a place out of the needled ground and curled up in it again. Her second night alone was no better than her first. Cold terror lay in the pit of her stomach along with her hunger. She had never been so terrified. She had never been so hungry. She had never been so alone. Her sense of loss was so painful, she began to block out the memory of the earthquake and her life before it. And thoughts of the future brought her so close to panic, she fought to push those fears from her mind as well. She didn't want to think about what might happen to her. Who would take care of her? She lived only for the moment, getting past the next obstacle, crossing the next tributary, scrambling over the next log. Following the stream became an end in itself. Not because it would take her anywhere, but because it was the only thing that gave her any direction, any purpose, any course of action. It was better than doing nothing. After a time, the emptiness in her stomach became a numb ache that deadened her mind. She cried now and then as she plodded on, her tears painting white streaks down her grubby face. Her small, naked body was caked with dirt, and hair that had once been nearly white and as fine and soft as silk was plastered to her head in a tangle of pine needles, twigs, and mud. Traveling became more difficult when the evergreen forest changed to more open vegetation, and the needle-covered forest floor gave way to obstructing brush, herbs, and grasses, the characteristic ground cover beneath small-leafed deciduous trees. When it rained, she huddled in the lee of a fallen log or large boulder or overhanging outcrop, or simply slogged through the mud, letting the rain wash over her. At night, she piled dry, brittle leaves left over from the previous season's growth into mounds and crawled into them to sleep. The plentiful supply of drinking water kept dehydration from making its dangerous contribution to hypothermia, the lowering of body temperature that brought death from exposure, but she was getting weak. She was beyond hunger. There was only a constant dull pain and an occasional feeling of lightheadedness. She tried not to think about it, or about anything except the stream, just following the stream. Sunlight penetrating her nest of leaves woke her. She got up from the snug pocket warmed by her body heat and went to the river for a morning drink, damp leaves still clinging to her. The blue sky and sunshine were welcome after the rain of the day before. Shortly after she started out, the bank on her side of the river gradually began to rise. By the time she decided to stop for another drink, a steep slope separated her from the water. She started down carefully, but lost her footing and tumbled all the way to the bottom. She lay in a scraped and bruised heap in the mud near the water, too tired, too weak, too miserable to move. Large tears welled up and streamed down her face, and plaintive wails rent the air. No one heard. Her cries became whimpers, begging someone to come and help her. No one came. Her shoulders heaved with sobs as she cried her desperation. She didn't want to get up. She didn't want to go on. But what else could she do? Just stay there, crying in the mud? After she stopped crying, she lay near the water's edge. When she noticed a root beneath her jabbing uncomfortably in her side and the taste of dirt in her mouth, she sat up. Then wearily, she stood up and went to the stream for a drink. She started walking again, doggedly pushing aside branches, crawling over moss-covered logs, splashing in and out of the edge of the river. The stream, already high from earlier spring floods, had swelled to more than double from tributaries. The child heard a roar in the distance, long before she saw the waterfall cascading down the high bank at the confluence of a large stream with a small river, a river about to double again. Beyond the waterfall, the swift currents of the combined watercourse bubbled over rocks as it flowed into the grassy plains of the steppes. The thundering cataract rushed over the lip of the high bank in a broad sheet of white water. It splashed into a foaming pool worn out of the rock at the base, creating a constant spray of mist and whirlpools of countercurrents where the rivers met. At some time in the distant past, the river had carved deeper into the hard stone cliff behind the waterfall. The ledge over which the water poured jutted out beyond the wall behind the falling stream, forming a passageway between. The girl edged in close and looked carefully into the damp tunnel, then started behind the moving curtain of water. She clutched at the wet rock to steady herself as the continuous falling, falling, falling of the flowing stream made her dizzy. The roar was deafening, rebounding from the stone wall in back of the tumultuous flow. She looked up fearfully, anxiously aware that the stream was above the dripping rocks over her head, and crept forward slowly. She was nearly to the other side, when the passageway ended, gradually narrowing until it was a steep wall again. The undercut in the cliff did not go all the way. She had to turn around and go back. When she reached her starting place, she looked at the torrent surging over the edge and shook her head. There was no other way. The water was cold as she waded into the river, and the current strong. She swam out to the middle and let the flow of the water carry her around the falls, then angled back to the bank of the widened river beyond. The swimming tired her, but she was cleaner than she had been for some time, except for her matted and tangled hair. She started out again, feeling refreshed, but not for long. The day was unseasonably warm for late spring, and when the trees and brush first gave way to the open prairie, the hot sun felt good. But as the fiery ball rose higher, its burning rays took their toll of the small girl's meager reserves. By afternoon, she was staggering along a narrow strip of sand between the river and a steep cliff. The sparkling water reflected the bright sun up at her, while the almost white sandstone bounced light and heat down, adding to the intense glare. Across the river and ahead, small herbaceous flowers of white, yellow, and purple, blending into the half-grown grass, bright green with new life, extended to the horizon. But the child had no eyes for the fleeting spring beauty of the steppes. Weakness and hunger were making her delirious. She started hallucinating.
"I said I'd be careful, Mother. I only swam a little ways. But where did you go?" she muttered. "Mother, when are we going to eat? I'm so hungry, and it's hot. Why didn't you come when I called you? I called and called, but you never came. Where have you been? Mother, Mother, don't go away again. Stay here. Mother, wait for me. Don't leave me."
She ran in the direction of the mirage as the vision faded, following the base of the cliff. But the cliff was pulling back from the water's edge, veering away from the river. She was leaving her source of water. Running blindly, she stubbed her toe on a rock and fell hard. It jarred her back to reality, almost. She sat rubbing her toe, trying to collect her thoughts. The jagged sandstone wall was pockmarked with dark holes of caves and streaked with narrow cracks and crevices. Expansion and contraction from extremes of searing heat and sub-zero cold had crumbled the soft rock. The child looked into a small hole near the ground in the wall beside her, but the tiny cave made little impression. Far more impressive was the herd of aurochs grazing peacefully on the lush new grass between the cliff and the river. In her blind rush to follow a mirage, she hadn't noticed the huge reddish-brown wild cattle, 6 feet high at the withers, with immense curving horns. When she did, sudden fear cleared the last cobwebs from her brain. She backed closer to the rock wall, keeping her eye on a burly bull that had stopped grazing to watch her. Then she turned and started running. She glanced back over her shoulder and caught her breath at a swift blur of movement and stopped in her tracks. An enormous lioness, twice as large as any feline who would populate savannas far to the south in a much later age, had been stalking the herd. The girl stifled a scream as the monstrous cat vaulted for a wild cow. In a flurry of snarling fangs and savage claws, the giant lioness wrestled the massive aurochs to the ground. With a crunch of powerful jaws, the terrified ball of the bovine was cut short as the huge carnivore tore out its throat. Spurting blood stained the muzzle of the four-legged hunter and sprayed her tawny fur with crimson. The auroch's legs jerked spasmodically, even as the lioness ripped open its stomach and tore out a chunk of warm, red meat. Stark terror charged through the girl. She fled in wild panic, carefully watched by another of the great cats. The child had stumbled into the territory of cave lions. Normally, the large felines would have disdained so small a creature as a 5-year-old human as prey, preferring a robust aurochs, oversized bison, or giant deer to satisfy the needs of a pride of hungry cave lions. But the fleeing child was approaching much too near to the cave that housed a pair of mewling newborn cubs. Left to guard the young while the lioness hunted, the shaggy-maned lion roared in warning. The girl jerked her head up and gasped at the gigantic cat crouched on a ledge ready to spring. She screamed, slid to a stop, falling and scraping her leg in the loose gravel near the wall, and scrambled to turn around. Spurred on by even greater fear, she ran back the way she had come. The cave lion leaped with languid ease, confident of his ability to catch the small interloper who dared to broach the sanctity of the cave nursery. He was in no hurry. She moved slowly compared with his fluid speed, and he was in the mood for a game of cat and mouse. In her panic, it was only instinct that led her to the small hole near the ground in the face of the cliff. Her side aching and gasping for breath, she squeezed through an opening barely big enough for her. It was a tiny, shallow cave, not much more than a crack. She twisted around in the cramped space until she was kneeling with her back to the wall, trying to melt into the solid rock behind her. The cave lion roared his frustration when he reached the hole and found his chase thwarted. The child trembled at the sound and stared in hypnotized horror as the cat snaked his paw, sharp curved claws outstretched, into the small hole. Unable to get away, she watched the claw come at her and shrieked in pain as it sunk into her left thigh, raking it with four deep, parallel gashes. The girl squirmed to get out of his reach and found a small depression in the dark wall to her left. She pulled her legs in, scrunched up as tight as she could, and held her breath. The claw slowly entered the small opening again, nearly blocking the scant light that penetrated the niche, but this time found nothing. The cave lion roared and roared as he paced back and forth in front of the hole. The child remained in the small, cramped cave through the day, that night, and most of the following day. The leg swelled, and the festering wound was a constant pain, and the small space inside the rough-walled cave had little room to turn or stretch out. She was delirious most of the time from hunger and pain, and dreamed terrifying nightmares of earthquakes and sharp claws and lonely, aching fear. But it wasn't her wound or her hunger, or even her painful sunburn that finally drove her from her refuge. It was thirst. She looked fearfully out of the small opening. Sparse stands of wind-stunted willow and pine near the river cast long shadows of early evening. The child stared at the grass-covered stretch of land and the sparkling water beyond for a long time before gathering up enough courage to move beyond the entrance. She licked cracked lips with a parched tongue as she scanned the terrain. Only the windswept grass moved. The lion pride was gone. The lioness, anxious for her young and uneasy about the unfamiliar scent of the strange creature so near their cave, decided to find a new nursery. The child crept out of the hole and stood up. Her head throbbed, and spots danced dizzily before her eyes. Waves of pain engulfed her with every step, and her wounds began to ooze a sickly yellow-green down her swollen leg. She wasn't sure if she could reach the water, but her thirst was overpowering. She fell to her knees and crawled the last few feet, then stretched out flat on her stomach and gulped greedy mouthfuls of cold water. When her thirst was finally slaked, she tried to stand again, but she had reached the limit of her endurance. Spots swam before her eyes, her head whirled, and everything went dark as she slumped to the ground. A carrion bird, circling lazily overhead, spied the unmoving form and swooped lower for a closer look. Chapter 2. The band of travelers crossed the river just beyond the waterfall, where it widened and foamed around rocks jutting up through the shallow water. They were 20 in number, young and old. The clan had totaled 26 before the earthquake that destroyed their cave. Two men led the way, far in front of a knot of women and children, flanked by a couple of older men. Younger men trailed behind. They followed the broad stream as it began its braided, meandering course across the flat steppes and watched the carrion birds circling. Flying scavengers usually meant that whatever had attracted their attention was still alive. The men in the lead hurried to investigate. A wounded animal was easy prey for hunters, providing no four-legged predators had similar ideas. A woman, midway along in her first pregnancy, walked in front of the rest of the women. She saw the two men in the lead glance at the ground and move on. It must be a meat-eater, she thought. The clan seldom ate carnivorous animals. She was just over 4.5 feet tall, large-boned, stocky and bow-legged, but walked upright on strong, muscular legs and flat, bare feet. Her arms, long in proportion to her body, were bowed like her legs. She had a large, beaky nose, a prognathous jaw jutting out like a muzzle, and no chin. Her low forehead sloped back into a long, large head, resting on a short, thick neck. At the back of her head was a bony knob, an occipital bun that emphasized its length. A soft down of short brown hair, tending to curl, covered her legs and shoulders, and ran along the upper spine of her back. It thickened into a head of heavy, long, rather bushy hair. She was already losing her winter pallor to a summer tan. Big, round, intelligent, dark brown eyes were deep-set below overhanging brow ridges, and they were filled with curiosity as she quickened her pace to see what the men had passed by. The woman was old for a first pregnancy, nearly 20, and the clan thought she was barren until the life stirring within her started to show. The load she carried had not been lightened because she was pregnant, however. She had a large basket strapped to her back, with bundles tied behind, hanging below, and piled on top of it. Several drawstring bags dangled from a thong, which was wrapped around the pliable hide she wore in such a way as to produce folds and pouches for carrying things. One bag was particularly distinctive. It was made from an otter hide, obviously so, because it had been cured with its waterproof fur, feet, tail, and head left intact. Rather than a slit in the skin of the animal's belly, only the throat had been cut to provide an opening to remove the innards, flesh, and bones, leaving a pouch-like bag. The head, attached by a strip of skin at the back, was the cover flap, and a red-dyed cord of sinew was threaded through holes punched around the neck opening, drawn tight, and tied to the thong at her waist. When the woman first saw the creature the men had left behind, she was puzzled by what appeared to be an animal without fur. But when she drew closer, she gasped and stepped back a pace, clutching the small leather pouch around her neck in an unconscious gesture to ward off unknown spirits. She fingered the small objects inside her amulet through the leather, invoking protection, and leaned forward to look closer, hesitant to take a step, but not quite able to believe she saw what she thought she was seeing. Her eyes had not deceived her. It was not an animal that had drawn the voracious birds. It was a child. A gaunt, strange-looking child. The woman looked around, wondering what other fearful enigmas might be nearby, and started to skirt the unconscious child, but she heard a moan. The woman stopped, and forgetting her fears, knelt beside the child and shook her gently. The medicine woman reached to untie the cord that held the otterskin bag closed as soon as she saw the festering claw marks and swollen leg when the girl rolled over. The man in the lead glanced back and saw the woman kneeling beside the child. He walked back to them.
"Issa, come," he commanded. "Cave lion tracks and scat ahead."
"It's a child, Brun. Hurt but not dead," she replied. Brun looked at the thin young girl with a high forehead, small nose, and strangely flat face.
"Not clan,"
the leader gestured abruptly and turned to walk away.
"Brun, she's a child. She's hurt. She'll die if we leave her here."
Issa's eyes pleaded as she made the hand signals. The leader of the small clan stared down at the imploring woman. He was much bigger than she, over 5 feet tall, heavily muscled and powerful, with a deep barrel chest and thick bowed legs. The cast of his features was similar, though more pronounced. Heavier superorbital ridges, larger nose. His legs, stomach, chest, and upper back were covered with a coarse brown hair that was not enough to be called a pelt, but not far from it. A bushy beard hid his chinless, jutting jaw. His wrap was similar, too, but not as full, cut shorter, and tied differently, with fewer folds and pouches for holding things. He carried no burdens, only his outer fur wrap suspended on his back by a wide band of leather wrapped around his sloping forehead, and his weapons. On his right thigh was a scar, blackened like a tattoo, shaped roughly like a U, with the tops flaring outward, the mark of his totem, the bison. He needed no mark or ornament to identify his leadership. His bearing and the deference of the others made his position clear. He shifted his club, the long foreleg of a horse, from his shoulder to the ground, supporting the handle with his thigh, and Issa knew he was giving her plea serious consideration. She waited quietly, hiding her agitation, to give him time to think. He set his heavy wooden spear down and leaned the shaft against his shoulder with the sharpened, fire-hardened point up, and adjusted the bola he wore around his neck along with his amulet, so the 3 stone balls were more evenly balanced. Then he pulled a strip of pliable deerskin, tapered at the ends, with a bulge in the middle to hold stones for slinging out of his waist thong, and pulled the soft leather through his hand, thinking. Brun didn't like making quick decisions about anything unusual that might affect his clan, especially now when they were homeless, and he resisted the impulse to refuse at once. "I should have known Issa would want to help her," he thought. "She's even used her healing magic on animals sometimes, especially young ones. She'll be upset if I don't let her help this child."
Clan or others, it makes no difference. All she can see is a child who is hurt. Well, maybe that's what makes her a good medicine woman. But medicine woman or not, she is just a woman. What difference will it make if she's upset? Issa knows better than to show it, and we have enough problems without a wounded stranger. But her totem will know. All the spirits will. Would it make them more angry if she's upset? If we find a cave... No. When we find a new cave, Issa will have to make her drink for the cave ceremony. What if she's so upset she makes a mistake? Angry spirits could make it go wrong, and they're angry enough already. Nothing must go wrong with a ceremony for the new cave. Let her take the child, he thought. She'll soon get tired of carrying the extra load, and the girl is so far gone, not even my sibling's magic may be strong enough to save her. Brunn tucked his sling back in his waist thong, picked up his weapons, and shrugged noncommittally. It was up to her. Issa could take the girl with them or not, as she pleased. He turned and strode off. Issa reached into her basket and pulled out a leather cloak. She wrapped it around the girl, hoisted her up, and secured the unconscious child to her hip with the aid of the supple hide, surprised at how little she weighed for her height. The girl moaned as she was lifted, and Issa patted her reassuringly, then fell into place behind the two men. The other women had stopped, holding back from the encounter between Issa and Brunn. When they saw the medicine woman pick something up and take it with her, their hands flew in rapid motions, punctuated by a few guttural sounds, discussing it with excited curiosity. Except for the otterskin pouch, they were dressed the same as Issa and as heavily burdened. Among them, they carried all the clan's worldly possessions, those that had been salvaged from the rubble after the quake. Two of the seven women carried babies in a fold of their wraps next to their skin, convenient for nursing. While they were waiting, one felt a drop of warm wetness, whipped her naked infant out of the fold, and held it in front of her until it was through wetting. When they weren't traveling, babies were often wrapped in soft swaddling skins. To absorb moisture and soft milky stools, any of several materials were packed around them. Fleece from wild sheep gathered from thorny shrubs when the mouflon were shedding, down from birds' breasts, or fuzz from fibrous plants. But while they traveled, it was easier and simpler to carry babies naked, and, without missing a step, let them mess on the ground. When they started out again, a third woman picked up a young boy, supporting him on her hip with a leather carrying cloak. After a few moments, he squirmed to get down and run by himself. She let him go, knowing he would be back when he got tired again. An older girl, not yet a woman, but carrying a woman's load, walked behind the woman who followed Issa, glancing back now and then at a boy, very nearly a man, trailing the women. He tried to allow enough distance between himself and them so it would seem he was one of the three hunters bringing up the rear and not one of the children. He wished he had game to carry, too, and even envied the old man, one of the two flanking the women, who carried a large hare over his shoulders, felled by a stone from his sling. The hunters were not the only source of food for the clan. The women often contributed the greater share, and their sources were more reliable. Despite their burdens, they foraged as they traveled, and so efficiently it hardly slowed them down. A patch of daylilies was quickly stripped of buds and flowers, and tender new roots exposed with a few strokes of the digging sticks. Cattail roots, pulled loose from beneath the surface of marshy backwaters, were even easier to gather. If they hadn't been on the move, the women would have made a point of remembering the location of the tall, stalky plants, to return later in the season to pick the tender tails at the top for a vegetable. Later still, yellow pollen mixed with starch pounded from the fibers of old roots would make doughy, unleavened biscuits. When the tops dried, fuzz would be collected, and several of the baskets were made from the tough leaves and stalks. Now they gathered only what they found, but little was overlooked. New shoots and tender young leaves of clover, alfalfa, dandelion, thistles stripped of prickles before they were cut down, a few early berries and fruits. The pointed digging sticks were in constant use. Nothing was safe for them in the women's deft hands. They were used as a lever to overturn logs for newts and delectable fat grubs. Freshwater mollusks were fished out of streams and pushed closer to shore for easy reach, and a variety of bulbs, tubers, and roots were dug out of the ground. It all found its way to the convenient folds of the women's wraps or an empty corner of their baskets. Large green leaves were wrappers, some of them, such as burdock, cooked as greens. Dry wood, twigs, and grass, and dung from grazing animals were collected too. Though the selection would be more varied later in the summer, food was plentiful, if one knew where to look. Issa looked up when an old man, past 30, hobbled up to her after they were on their way again. He carried neither burden nor weapon, only a long staff to help him walk. His right leg was crippled and smaller than the left, yet he managed to move with surprising agility. His right shoulder and upper arm were atrophied, and the shriveled arm had been amputated below the elbow. The powerful shoulder and arm and muscular leg of his fully developed left side made him appear lopsided. His huge cranium was even larger than those of the rest of the clan, and the difficulty of his birth had caused the defect that crippled him for life. He was also a sibling of Issa and Brunn, firstborn, and would have been leader but for his affliction. He wore a leather wrap cut in the masculine style and carried his warm outer fur, which was also used as a sleeping fur, on his back as the other men did. But he had several pouches hanging from his waist thong, and a cloak similar to the kind the women used, which held a large, bulging object to his back. The left side of his face was hideously scarred, and his left eye was missing. But his good right eye sparkled with intelligence, and something more. For all his hobbling, he moved with a grace that came from great wisdom and a sureness of his place within the clan. He was Mogur, the most powerful magician, most awesome and revered holy man of all the clans. He was convinced that his wasted body was given to him so that he could take his place as intermediary with the spirit world rather than at the head of his clan. In many ways, he had more power than any leader, and he knew it. Only close relatives remembered his birth name and called him by it. "Crib," Issa said in greeting and acknowledged his appearance with a motion that meant she was pleased he had joined her. "Issa?" he questioned with a gesture toward the child she carried. The woman opened her cloak, and Kreb looked closely at the small, flushed face. His eye traveled down to the swollen leg and suppurating wound, then back to the medicine woman, and read meaning from her eyes. The girl moaned, and Kreb's expression softened. He nodded his approval. "Good," he said. The word was gruff, guttural. Then he made a sign that meant, "Enough have died." Kreb stayed beside Issa. He didn't have to conform to the understood rules that defined each person's position and status. He could walk with anyone, including the leader if he chose. Mogur was above and aside from the strict hierarchy of the clan. Brunn led them well beyond the spoor of cave lions before he stopped and studied the landscape. Across the river, as far as he could see, the prairie stretched out in low, rolling hills into a flat green expanse in the distance. His view was unobstructed. The few stunted trees, distorted by the constant wind into caricatures of arrested motion, merely put the open country in perspective and emphasized the emptiness. Near the horizon, a cloud of dust betrayed the presence of a large herd of hard-hoofed animals, and Brunn sorely wished he could signal his hunters and take out after them. Behind him, only the tops of tall conifers could be seen beyond the smaller deciduous trees of the forest, already dwarfed by the vastness of the steppes. On his side of the river, the prairie ended abruptly, cut off by the cliff now some distance away and angling ever farther from the stream ahead. The rock face of the steep wall merged into the foothills of majestic glacier-topped mountains, looming near, their icy peaks vibrant with vivid pinks, magentas, violets, and purples reflecting the setting sun, gigantic sparkling jewels crowning the sovereign summits. Even the practical leader was moved by the pageant. He turned away from the river and led his clan toward the cliff, which held out the possibility of caves. They needed a shelter, but almost more important, their protective totem spirits needed a home if they hadn't already deserted the clan. They were angry. The earthquake proved that. Angry enough to cause the death of 6 of the clan and destroy their home. If a permanent place for the totemic spirits was not found, they would leave the clan to the mercy of evil ones that caused illness and chased game away. No one knew why the spirits were angry, not even Mogur, though he conducted nightly rituals to appease their wrath and help relieve the clan's anxiety. They were all worried, but none more than Brunn. The clan was his responsibility, and he felt the strain. Spirits, those unseen forces with unfathomable desires, baffled him. He was more comfortable in the physical world, hunting and leading his clan. None of the caves he had examined so far were suitable. They all lacked some condition that was essential, and he was getting desperate. Precious warm days when they should have been storing food for the next winter were being wasted in the search for a new home. Soon he might be forced to shelter his clan in a less than adequate cave and continue the search next year. That would be unsettling, physically and emotionally, and Brunn fervently hoped it would not be necessary. They walked along the base of the cliff as the shadows deepened. When they reached a narrow waterfall bouncing down the rock wall, its spray a shimmering rainbow in the long rays of the sun, Brunn called a halt. Wearily, the women set down their burdens and fanned out along the pool at the bottom and its narrow outlet to find wood. Issa spread out her fur wrap and put the child on it, then hurried to help the other women. She was worried about the girl. Her breathing was shallow, and she hadn't roused. Even her moans came less frequently. Issa had been thinking about how to help the child, considering the dried herbs she carried in her otterskin pouch, and while she gathered wood, she looked over the plants growing in the vicinity. To her, whether it was familiar or not, everything had some value, medicinal or nutritional, but there was little she couldn't identify. When she saw long stalks of iris ready to bloom on the marshy bank of the little creek, it settled one question, and she dug up its roots. The three-lobed hop leaves twining around one of the trees gave her another idea. But she decided to use the powdered, dry hops she had with her, since the cone-like fruit would not mature until later. She peeled smooth grayish bark from an alder shrub growing near the pool and sniffed it. It was strongly aromatic, and she nodded to herself as she put it in a fold of her wrap. Before she hurried back, she picked several handfuls of young clover leaves. When the wood was gathered and the fireplace set, Grad, the man who walked in front with Brunn, uncovered a glowing coal wrapped in moss and stuffed it into the hollow end of an aurochs horn. They could make fire, but while traveling through unknown territory, it was easier to take a coal from one campfire and keep it alive to start the next one than to try to start a new fire each evening with possibly inadequate materials. Grad had nurtured the burning ember anxiously while they traveled. The hot coal from the fire of the night before had been started by a hot coal from the previous evening's fire and could be traced back to the fire they had rekindled on the remains of the fireplace at the mouth of the old cave. For the rights to make a new cave acceptable for residents, they needed to start the fire from a coal they could trace back to their old home. Maintenance of the fire could only be entrusted to a male of high status. If the coal died out, it would be a sure sign that their protective spirits had deserted them, and Grad would be demoted from second in command to the lowest-ranked male position in the clan, a humiliation he did not care to suffer. His was a great honor and a heavy responsibility. While Grad carefully placed the bit of burning charcoal on a bed of dry tinder and blew it into flame, the women turned to other tasks. With techniques passed down for generations, they quickly skinned the game. A few moments after the fire was blazing well, meat skewered with sharp green sticks set over forked branches was roasting. The high heat seared it to hold in juices, and when the fire died down to coals, little was lost to the licking flames. With the same sharp stone knives they used to skin and cut the meat, the women scraped and sliced roots and tubers. Tightly woven waterproof baskets and wooden bowls were filled with water, and then hot stones were added. When cooled, the stones were put back in the fire, and new ones were put in the water until it boiled and the vegetables cooked. Fat grubs were toasted crisp, and small lizards roasted whole until their tough skins blackened and cracked, exposing tasty bits of well-cooked flesh. Issa made her own preparations while helping with the meal. In a wooden bowl that she had chipped out of a section of log many years before, she started water boiling. She washed the iris roots, chewed them to a pulp, and spit them into the boiling water. In another bowl, the cup-shaped piece from the lower jaw of a large deer, she crushed clover leaves, measured out a quantity of powdered hops into her hand, tore the alder bark into shreds, and poured boiling water over it. Then she ground hard, dry meat from their preserved emergency ration into a coarse meal between two stones, and mixed the concentrated protein with water from cooking vegetables in a third bowl. The woman who had walked behind Issa cast an occasional glance her way, hoping Issa would volunteer some comment. All the women and the men, though they tried not to show it, were bursting with curiosity. They had seen Issa pick the girl up, and everyone had found a reason to walk near Issa's fur after they made camp. Speculation ran high about how the child happened to be there, where the rest of her people were, and mostly why Brunn had allowed Issa to take a girl along who was obviously born to the others. Abra knew better than anyone the strain Brunn was feeling. She was the one who tried to massage the tension out of his neck and shoulders, and she was the one who bore the brunt of his nervous temper, so rare in the man who was her mate. Brunn was known for his stoic self-control, and she knew he regretted his outbursts, though he would not compound his transgression by admitting it. But even Abra wondered why he had allowed the child to come with them, especially when any deviation from normal behavior might increase the anger of the spirits. As curious as she was, Abra asked no questions of Issa, and none of the other women had enough status to consider it. No one disturbed a medicine woman when she was obviously working her magic, and Issa was in no mood for idle gossip. Her concentration was directed at the child who needed her help. Kreb was interested in the girl too, but Issa welcomed his presence. She watched with silent gratitude while the magician shuffled over to the unconscious child, looked at her thoughtfully for a while, then leaned his staff against a large boulder and made flowing one-handed motions over her, a request to benevolent spirits to assist in her recovery. Illness and accidents were mysterious manifestations of the war of the spirits, fought on the battleground of the body. Issa's magic came from protective spirits who acted through her, but no cure was complete without the holy man. A medicine woman was only an agent of the spirits. A magician interceded directly with them. Issa didn't know why she felt such concern for a child so different from the clan, but she wanted her to live. When Mogur was through, Issa lifted the girl in her arms and carried her to the small pool at the foot of the waterfall. She submerged all but her head and washed away dirt and caked mud from the thin little body. The cool water revived the youngster, but she was delirious. She tossed and writhed, calling out in mumbling sounds like none the woman had ever heard before. Issa held the girl close as she walked back with her, making soothing murmurs that sounded like soft growls. Gently, but with experienced thoroughness, Issa washed the wounds with an absorbent piece of rabbit skin dipped in the hot liquid in which the iris root had boiled. Then she scooped out the root pulp, put it directly on the wounds, covered it with the rabbit skin, and wrapped the child's leg in strips of soft deerskin to hold the poultice in place. She removed the mashed clover, the shredded alder bark, and stones from the bone bowl with a forked twig, and set it to cool beside the bowl of hot broth. Kreb gestured inquiringly toward the bowls. It was not a direct query. Not even Mogur would question a medicine woman directly about her magic. It only indicated interest. Issa didn't mind her sibling's interest. He, more than anyone, appreciated her knowledge. He used some of the same herbs she did, for different purposes. Except for clan gatherings, where there were other medicine women, talking to Kreb was the closest she could come to a discussion with a professional colleague. "This destroys the evil spirits that make infection," Issa motioned, pointing to the antiseptic iris root solution. "A poultice of the root draws out poisons and helps the wound heal." She picked up the bone bowl and dipped in a finger to check the temperature. "Clover makes the heart strong to fight evil spirits, stimulates it." Issa used a few spoken words when she talked, but primarily for emphasis. The people of the clan could not articulate well enough for a complete verbal language. They communicated more with gestures and motions, but their sign language was fully comprehensive and rich with nuance. "Clover is food. We had it last night," Kreb signed. "Yes," Issa nodded, "and we will tonight. The magic is in the way it's prepared. A large bunch boiled in little water extracts what is needed. The leaves are thrown out." Kreb nodded with understanding, and she went on. "Alder bark cleans the blood, purifies it, drives out the spirits that poison it." "You used something from your medicine bag, too." "Powdered hops, the mature cones with the fine hairs to calm her and make her sleep restfully. While the spirits battle, she needs rest." Kreb nodded again. He was familiar with the soporific qualities of hops that induced a mild state of euphoria in a different use. Though he was always interested in Issa's treatments, he seldom volunteered information about the ways he used herbal magic. Such esoteric knowledge was for Mogurs and their acolytes, not women, not even medicine women. Issa knew more about the properties of plants than he did, and he was afraid she would deduce too much. It would be most unpropitious if she guessed much about his magic.
And the other bowl? He asked.
That's just broth. The poor thing is half-starved. What do you suppose happened to her? Where did she come from? Where are her people? She must have been wandering alone for days.
Only the spirits know, Mogul replied. Are you sure your healing magic will work on her? She's not clan.
It should. The others are human, too. You remember Mother telling about the man with a broken arm? The one her mother helped. Clan magic worked on him, although Mother did say it took him longer to wake up from the sleeping medicine than expected.
It's a shame you never knew her, our mother's mother. She was such a good medicine woman. People came from other clans to see her. It's too bad she left to walk the spirit world so soon after you were born, Issa. She told me about that man herself. So did Mogur before me. He stayed for a while after he recovered and hunted with the clan. He must have been a good hunter. He was allowed to join a hunting ceremony. It's true, they are human. But different, too.
Mogur stopped. Issa was too astute. He couldn't afford to say too much, or she might begin to draw some conclusions about the men's secret rituals. Issa checked her bowls again, then cradling the child's head on her lap, she fed her the contents of the bone bowl in small sips. It was easier to feed her the broth. The girl mumbled incoherently and tried to fight off the bitter-tasting medicine. But even in her delirium, her starving body craved food. Issa held her until she lapsed into a quiet sleep, then checked her heartbeat and breathing. She had done what she could. If the girl wasn't too far gone, she had a chance. It was up to the spirits now, and the inner strength of the child. Issa saw Brunn walking toward her, eyeing her with displeasure. She got up quickly and ran to help serve the meal. He had dismissed the strange child from his mind after his initial consideration, but now he was having second thoughts. Though it was customary to avert the eyes to avoid seeing other people in conversation, he couldn't help noticing what his clan was saying. Their wondering at his allowing the girl to come with them made him begin to wonder, too. He began to fear the spirit's anger might be aroused more by the stranger in their midst. He veered to intercept the medicine woman, but Krebs saw him and headed him off.
"What's wrong, Brunn? You look worried." "Issa must leave that child here, Mogur. She is not clan. The spirits won't like it if she is with us while we're looking for a new cave. I never should have let Issa take her."
"No, Brunn," Mogur countered. "Protective spirits are not angered by kindness. You know Issa. She can't bear to see anything hurting without trying to help.
Don't you think the spirits know her too? If they didn't want Issa to help her, the child would not have been put in her path. There must be a reason for it. The girl may die anyway, Brunn. But if Ursus wants to call her to the spirit world, let the decision be his. Don't interfere now. She will surely die if she is left behind."
Brunn didn't like it. Something about the girl bothered him. But deferring to Mogur's greater knowledge of the spirit world, he acquiesced. Kreb sat in contemplative silence after the meal, waiting for everyone to finish eating so he could begin the nightly ceremony, while Issa arranged his sleeping place and made preparations for the morning. Mogur had put a ban on men and women sleeping together until a new cave was found, so the men could concentrate their energies on the rituals, and so everyone would feel they were making an effort that would bring them closer to a new home. It didn't matter to Issa. Her mate had been one of those killed in the cave-in. She had mourned him with proper grief at his burial. It would have been unlucky to do otherwise, but she was not unhappy he was gone. It was no secret he had been cruel and demanding. There had never been any warmth between them. She didn't know what Brunn would decide to do with her now that she was alone. Someone would have to provide for her and the child she carried. She only hoped she could still cook for Kreb. He had shared their fire from the beginning. Issa sensed he hadn't liked her mate any more than she had, though he never interfered with the internal problems of her relationship. She had always felt it was an honor to cook for Mogur, but more, she had developed a bond of affection for her sibling, like many women grew to feel for their mates. Issa felt sorry for Kreb sometimes. He could have had a mate of his own, had he wanted one. But she knew, for all his great magic and exalted position, no woman ever looked at his deformed body and scarred face without revulsion, and she was sure he knew it. He never took a mate, maintained a reserve. It added to his stature. Everyone, men included, with the possible exception of Prun, feared Mogur or regarded him with awe. Everyone but